You know, Jesus said that we are to become like little children if we are to enter the kingdom of God. I want to turn to Matthew 18 and read that. Matthew 18 and start in verse 1. Matthew chapter 18 and verse 1. I really like that passage because it says, at that time the disciples came to Jesus saying, who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Isn't that the way of the world? Everybody has to be under some kind of authority, some way. Think about it. We start out that way. We're born and we're under our parents' authority right off the bat. They're gods to us, let's face it, because we don't know any better. We don't know anything else. And the whole system is that way, all the way from top to bottom, in the world in which you and I live. And who is the head of everything as far as this world is concerned? Satan, the devil, is the god of this world. He wants to be top one. Think about it. It's the way the system works all the way up and down the scale in the world we live in. Seems like we always have to have somebody over us for some reason in higher leadership than what we are. That's the system. Jesus Christ worked just contrary to that, if you really think about it. I want to read this in Matthew 18. It says that they wanted to know who was the greatest. And verse 2 says, then Jesus called a little child to him and set him in the midst of them and said, assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted, change from that way, that system, and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. You won't get there. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. He answered their question real simply and effectively, may I say. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. Tremendous statement. How do we as old hardened adults become like a little child? It's not that easy. Because we've gotten set in our ways and we automatically react to certain things according to the system in which we live. We all have and done, to whatever degree that may be and whatever position we may find ourselves in this world. But the whole system sort of works that way. I believe you agree with that anyway. It seems to me like it's inevitable. That's just the way it is, all the way up and down the scale. Now, we know, I already said who wanted to be the top one, of course. And that is a system, that we live in irrespective of what position we may have along the way. There isn't anyone that doesn't have some kind of power over them. I don't think there is anyone like that. We have people that have been total dictators and emperors in countries and so forth, and they think they can be the top, but they have to find out ultimately that there are other countries that can take them over too. And that's what happens at times. It just doesn't work. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about how you and I live in this world and the effects of all of that as far as we are concerned. 1 Peter, the second chapter. I'll turn to that while I'm right here, while I'm thinking about this. 1 Peter, the second chapter. I thought it'd be good just to read the Apostle Peter's discussion of this, right? So simple. 1 Peter 2 and verse 1. Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and evil speaking, we have to lay that all aside as far as we are concerned. I I have to repent bitterly of the fact that I was in the Army and my language just wasn't the best, I'll assure you, while I was in the, among all the military boys and all of this. And there was plenty of deceit and hypocrisy and evil speaking. But in verse 2, he says, as newborn babes desire the pure milk of the Word. Now, people can have the milk of the Word, and they come up with all kinds of their ideas. You know that, and I know that. The world's full of that. We have it all the time. But is that the pure milk of the Word, that you may grow thereby? We need to follow that as far as that is concerned, if indeed you have trusted that the Lord is gracious. That isn't always the picture that is always painted of God either. Now, I brought the little parables, and I've read this to probably you, some of you before. You've probably heard me give some of this in sermons before, but a parable of how to be led to the Father. Now, I'm sort of placing this in terms, if you think that I'm mainly talking to the fathers and the men, yes, true, but it's parenting in general, may I put it that way, because it fits all the way up and down the scale. But this parable number one says, and I'll just read it as it was written by someone, it says, I took a little child's hand in mine. He and I were to walk together for a while. I was to lead him to the Father. It was a task that overcame me. So awful was the responsibility. I talked to the little child only of the Father. I painted the sternness of the Father's face. We walked under tall trees. I said the Father had the power to send them crashing down, struck by his thunderbolts. We walked in the sunshine. I told him of the greatness of the Father who made the burning, blazing sun. One twilight we met the Father. The child hid behind me. He was afraid. He would not put his hand in the Father's hand. I was between the child and the Father. I wondered. I had been so conscientious, so serious. Did he do the right kind of fathering? Pretty obviously not. The child wouldn't even meet the Father. That is not the way to teach children. A very good example of how not to do it. We have that example. We're not to teach them to fear a loving God. God is love. I don't even have to turn to that, I don't think. 1 John 4:8, if you want the scripture, you can write it down. 1 John 4:8 and 16, both. God is love. God is the epitome of all love. And he loves all of the people that will make an effort to obey him, really. And we shouldn't paint that kind of a picture before God. A picture to fear him as a tyrant, as an overbearing being. I want to read the second parable that I have here. It says, I took a little child's hand in mine. I was to lead him to the Father. I felt burdened by the multitude of things that I was to teach him. We did not ramble. We hastened from spot to spot. In one moment we compared the leaves of the tree, and the next we were examining a bird's nest. And while the child was questioning me about it, I hurried him away to chase the butterflies. Did he chance to fall asleep? I wakened him, lest he should miss something that I wished him to see. We spoke of the Father often and rapidly. I poured into his ears all the stories he ought to know, and we were interrupted often by the wind, of which we must trace to its source. But then in the twilight, we met the Father. The child merely glanced at him. The father stretched out his hand, but the child was not interested enough to take it. Feverish spots burned on his cheeks. He dropped exhausted to the ground and fell asleep. Again, I was between the child and the father. And I wondered, I taught him so many, many things. Is that the way to teach a child? Not to burn them out, just hurrying them to all together. They get that kind of a picture of that's the way God is. And that isn't the picture that we want to paint of God, not to the children at all. Now, I know these are just parables, and I'm only using them as someone's illustration of this sort of thing. And I want to read the third one here. It says, I took a little child's hand in mine to lead him to the Father. My heart was full of gratitude for the glad service, for the glad privilege. We walked slowly. I suited my steps to the short steps of the child. We spoke of the things the child noticed. Sometimes it was one of the father's birds. We watched it build a nest and saw the eggs which it laid. We wondered later of the care it gave its young. Sometimes we picked the father's flowers and stroked in their soft petals and loved their bright colors. Often we told stories of the father. I told them to the child, and the child told them to me. We told them, the child and I, over and over and over again. Sometimes we stopped to lean, resting against the father's tree, and letting his air cool our brow, and never speaking. Then in the twilight, we met the father. The child's eyes shone. He looked up lovingly, trustingly, eagerly into the father's face. He put his hand in the father's hand. I, for the moment, was forgotten. I was content. Now, I know it's just parables, but I read them just to give an illustration of how not to do it and how to do it in one sense of the word. I wanted to point this out because we need to realize the importance of child teaching and training from the standpoint of the frame of mind and attitude that we want to build into them. Now, I wish I had known this when all my children were born. I was 30 years of age, and 35 years of age, and already had five children before I was ever baptized. Now, I learned an awful lot about teaching children after I was baptized. And while I surely can't say too much for my training before, as far as that goes, we did try to do our best to teach them at least obedience to parents and so forth, and obedience to God. Now, one of the things that came out of that very early all the time was we tried to teach them that God has to come first, high above everything. Now, you don't just tell them that to start with, because all they know, the only God they know when they're first born and real small, is their parents. Let's face it. They don't know anybody else at this stage. If they have anything happens, well, they got to run to their parents. They don't have anywhere else to go. So, where do they go? You teach them that the parents, too, have to rely on God, and that we have to truly rely on God and mean it. And we have to teach the children this sort of thing. We have to teach them this over and over and over again. How did Jesus relate to his disciples? He was a physical human being. Did he relate to them by leading them to the Father in a way of a frightful, fearful way or anything of this nature. That was foolishness. He didn't do that. Conversely, he didn't go from the standpoint that he always said the Father is greater than I, but he said that we are equal too, that we're together, all together. Now, he didn't say that he was the same as the Father when he was a physical human being here. I don't mean to imply that at all, because he said in the case whenever the young man came to him and wanted to know what to do, he says, in order to be good, he says, good master, what must I do? And he says, why do you call me good? Think about that. He was physical, capable of doing the same things you do. He never did, of course. He never sinned. And all others have sinned and come short of the glory of God. But he didn't. But he could have, at least that it was, I say he could have from the standpoint of it was feasible if he had made that mistake and lost all. Now, we don't even want to think of that side of it, of course, because he didn't. And he is our Savior, but he could have. That's what I'm saying. I want to turn to the 13th chapter of John. We do this at Passover time, of course. You all know that. That 13th chapter of John is talking about foot washing. And I want to point out here the frame of mind and attitude that our Savior had among us as physical human beings. I say among us because he was among his disciples and they were at that what we call the Last Supper at this stage. But in verse 10, Jesus said, he who is as bathed does not need washing after he washed their feet. You see, he washed their feet, took a towel about him and washed their feet. And Peter said, you're not going to wash my feet. And he said, well, if I don't wash you, you don't have anything to do with me. Oh, well, Peter says, then wash me all over, you know, my hands and my body, everything, the head and everything. Jesus said, verse 10, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are all clean, but not all of you. And he knew who he was talking about there, of course. But verse 12, when he had washed their feet, taken up his garments, when he had washed their feet, he took the position of the lowest of the slaves. That was the position of the bottom of the deck, the lowest of the slaves. And Jesus took that position? No wonder it dumbfounded. Peter says, you're not going to wash my feet. He wasn't going to yield to that. Not to Jesus Christ, his teacher, doing all of that, surely. But he did. He said, you have to become as little children? I don't mean that you have to go back to that size and intelligent level of a little tiny baby, because that's impossible. We know that. But what was he talking about? He was talking about having that mind, that way of thinking about these things with one another. I have stood here many times and told you people, I want to know how you look at certain things. If you come up with ideas, I love it. I want to know how you think about certain things. I learn from that. You think I can't learn from you? Surely I can. And I do. And I appreciate it very much. Now, I'm supposed to be your teacher. And if I don't, and having studied the scriptures for 42 years, as I have dealt with people day in and day out with the Bible, and if I don't know the Bible a little better than most of you do, why, there's something wrong with me. But that doesn't mean that I'm any better than you are. And I think we need to get that picture that Jesus Christ came all the way down to the lowest of the slaves in order to get them to see the picture that we're going to be equal. They couldn't get it. Let me read that verse here now. Verse 12, he took his garments again. He sat down again. He said to them, you know what I've done to you? I don't believe they got it, really, did they? He said, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am." Sure he was. He was their teacher. He taught them all the time. He knew much more than all of them. And he was able to teach them. How did he do it? "You sit down here, I'm the boss around here." Was that the way he went at it? No way. No way. He put a towel around his waist and washed their feet. Now there was a tremendous lesson there, if we really get it, to get to the level of a little child. That's what he said. You've got to become like a little child or you won't even enter the kingdom. Now, that means in frame of mind and attitude that he had. And we have talked about the equality that has to be there. That equality has to be there because if it isn't, then there's going to be rough spots. Hatreds will arise and things of that nature among various peoples and things. But there won't be any of that in God's kingdom. Ever really think about that? That can't be. So we somehow have got to get to that level that Jesus Christ exemplified when he did this. Now, I stopped in verse 13. He says, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your teacher, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet." In other words, you need to assume that level also. Now, we do that in practice every Passover. But, "For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done." For what purpose? For the same purpose he did it. Come down to that level where we're all the same. I have been in churches and I have been to people's homes and see children, and they kind of like me. They sort of take to me because I talk to the little ones. And when they come to church, why, sometimes they'll come up the aisle and I'll just get right down on my knees right down there with them. And I've had people, a minister, get down there with a little kid like that. Yes. You know, it helps them to get down on their level, to be frank about it, and to speak on their level, to talk on their level, and to think like they do, and then take it from there and teach them. It's a principle, a simple principle. It works. It works in all levels as far as that goes. Solomon had that capability when he was before he went awry in his life. But you know, Solomon, the whole world, there wasn't a kingdom in the whole worldwide world that didn't look to Solomon for wisdom. And practically all of them came to him, too, incidentally. And he answered them all. Every single one. He was capable of doing that. But how did he do it? Well, the Queen of Sheba just about said it all when she came there and she says, "I came here and I saw how your servants react, and the smiles on their faces," and I'm paraphrasing it, of course, but how happy they are and all of this. And she said she was dumbfounded by that. That's the way it should be. Now, I don't mean that's God's kingdom, because none of them were there as far as that part was concerned, but it was an example. That's all. It was an example of how it's better to be done that way. I wish we could grasp that as far as we are concerned. I had an incident happen in my life I want to talk about. It wasn't this. As I said, I didn't do the right kind of an example, perhaps, to teach my children. But we got them taught, at least in a way, that they did respect their parents and they respected God first. We had an incident happen just 2 weeks after Mrs. Armstrong died in 1967. Our little mongoloid girl was just turned 12 years of age, and she died. Just 2 weeks after Mr. Armstrong Mrs. Armstrong died, Mrs. Loma Armstrong. I came home from Ambassador College. I was going down there auditing some Bible courses at that time. And I came home about noon and asked how little Diana was doing at that time. Of course, she'd in all of her life, she would hardly ever get sick. The children would have measles and mumps and all of the childhood diseases along the way. I think they had them all at one time or another. And she'd just be running around playing all the time. She would have them so light that they never would be even faze her. And the rest of them would be in bed. Well, this time she got a sore throat. And she got a sore throat that was so bad that this is something that was never happened to her, that's all. And couldn't get her to get anything down her throat. Now, you didn't go to a doctor in those days, not back at that time. All of you are old enough to know better than that. You know how we looked at that sort of thing. We tried everything. My wife worked with her all the time, trying to get her to even just swallow a water or take anything in to get anything in the way of nourishment in her, and we couldn't. I came home from Ambassador College that day when she died. And I asked my wife how she was doing, and she said, well, she's went to the bathroom, and she's been, not able to get any liquid in her whatsoever, and her urine got so strong that it was just burning her, and she was hurting and crying. Well, I walked into the bathroom, and I just picked her up, and she wrapped her arms around me, of course. Always loved Daddy, and I carried her into bed, laid her down, and went out to eat the lunch my wife had made for me. And I just got into eating the lunch, and all at once my wife called. She went right in with her, was just there beside her bedside. All at once she called, Daddy, you better come in here. And when she said that, the way she said it, I knew I better come in there, because she didn't talk that way unless it was a pretty dire emergency of some kind. Well, I ran in, and she was already in ring-straight breathing, gasping, and then catching and breathing a little bit, and then stop again. Well, when she would stop, I gave her some artificial resuscitation, and she'd catch again and breathe a couple of times, and it kept getting worse. And I saw it was getting worse. I had checked her pulse and found out her heart was beating just as fine as could be, as far as it was concerned, but she quit breathing. She died. Now, I knew that whenever she wouldn't catch again, she started breathing, that I wasn't going to have her there in the home, when dying right there in the house. So I just wrapped her up in the bed sheet there and told my daughter to get in the car, and I put her in her lap, and we went down to a hospital just a couple blocks down the street. And I drove right into the emergency room, and sheriff's deputy ran out there, and, you can't park in here! And I says, I think I've got a dead baby. Oh. He grabbed the door and took the child and ran into the emergency room. Of course, I had to drive the car out. I drove it just around, parked it right there in the emergency section, but out of the emergency driveway, and came in. The doctors and assistants there worked on her for some time. Pretty soon the doctor walked out and he said, have you got any more children? And one of them was standing right there with me, of course, it helped when we took her down. And I said, well, yeah, I've got five others. Bring them down here. It was a direct order. Sheriff's deputy was standing there, and he didn't say a word, of course. I didn't either at that stage. What is going on here? Well, he said, turned to that sheriff's deputy, and he says, go get those children. Well, the sheriff's deputy didn't faze him a bit. He don't take orders from him, so he didn't do anything. He turned around in anger and he said, oh, your baby's dead. That sheriff even cringed over that one. That's a fine way to tell me that my child was dead. Come out there with like that. But anyway, that's neither here nor there at that stage. The sheriff went back and got the papers. So, you know, you always got to take papers to the hospital to sign the patient, the information about the patient, so forth. Well, I did that, filled that out, and the sheriff says, you can go on home now. Well, that doctor says, I'm going to call the county officials, and they'll come out and take those children. What do I do? I could go home. I went home. I went home and I had to tell my wife and those five children, I said, the county officials are coming to take you away from us. Now, what did the children do? I went to the telephone and I called what we used as a family doctor back in those days. There was a doctor that the church sanctioned down in Pasadena, and I knew this doctor, so I called him and asked him if I could bring the children in and have him take a look at them, because they were all healthy by now. They'd been over all of it and they were all healthy, no problem. Well, then the county officials came to get the children. I was standing in the screen door when they drove up, and they drove up to the up in front of our house, and of course they looked over and saw me standing there. He probably figured I had a shotgun, I don't know, but anyway, I was standing in front of the door, so they just pulled on down to past the edge of my driveway over to the next house and stopped, got out of the car and came to the door. When they did, I just opened the door and said, come on in. So they came in, and here was my wife and five children. Sit down. They sit down on the couch there in the living room, and the man that was leading this group looked around the house and my five children there and my wife, and he says, are these the children that are in contention? And I said, yes, sir, you can ask any one of them anything you want. He looked around and he turned over to his assistant and he said, I think I've seen enough already, haven't you? And they got up and walked out. Well, my children were sitting there. You know, they were, well, they had standing, some of them, and with my wife there. And I was too. And they said, when the county officials were coming to take them away, don't worry, Dad. Don't worry about it. You've taught us all our lives that God will take care of us. Just forget it. Don't worry about it. I won't forget that. I'll never forget that. Because that helped me a great deal at that stage. And I think it was the turning point of that whole situation. Because the officials got up and walked out and said they'd seen enough. And I told him then, whenever they started walking out the door, I said, well, look, I've already called my own physician and called him and told him that I'd like to have him take a look at them, make sure that everything's okay. He said, that's all that's needed. Don't worry about it. And he left. And that was the end of it. You know, I never heard one iota from that hospital, one kind of a bill or one kind of a statement or one kind of anything. Never heard anything from any of them after that, because they didn't like that idea that I wasn't going to say any more to them until I talked to an attorney. They didn't like that language, I'll assure you. Now, I didn't say it for that reason either, but that was simple fact. I just wasn't going to talk to this guy in the frame of mind and he was in when my children were all healthy. And, well, it was an incident that I wanted to describe to you in terms of how children can react, at least. And ours did. at that stage. And I appreciate that more than I can ever stand here and tell you, because I felt a closeness then to our children and family that I never ever had before in sense of the word. I know that God said that He chose Abraham, and Abraham was a loyal and faithful, kept His commandments and His laws. But in Genesis, the 18th chapter, and I did look it up. I don't even have it in my notes, but I looked it up there, and I think I know the verse all right. Genesis 18 and verse 19. Genesis 18 and verse 19, which says, "For I have known him," Abraham that is, "in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the eternal, to do righteousness and justice, that the eternal may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him." I think we were blessed because of God's blessing of Abraham, to be frank about it. And I always felt that God, he set an example that was good for us to follow. That the children followed him. His son was willing to go with him and be sacrificed if he had to. You know that. I'm not going into that story. That's in the 22nd chapter of Genesis, if you want it. But it says that we need to teach our children a picture of God that is a correct picture, that they can rely on Him over and above anything else in this whole wide world. And I found out at least that the children got that, to whatever degree they got it, at least they were willing to do it right then and there. Now, they weren't taken away from us, as it happened, as a result of all of that, because they were right there. They didn't make any complaints. They were all right there, and they could have asked them anything. They didn't ever ask them a question after they saw them. And I think they recognized the fact that they weren't a bunch of brutal, disobedient children. But parenting, fathering, parents, teaching children the right ways about God. What is that? You know, what's it all going to be like in God's kingdom? Isn't that what we want to teach them? We want to teach them what it's going to be like in God's kingdom. It's not going to be like this world in which we live now, where always has to be somebody over you, over you, over you, over you, over you. Jesus said He was willing to call you brethren. I shouldn't quote it. Not Hebrews, the second chapter. Let's turn to it. I'll turn to it, and then I can read it. If I can find it, that is. Verse 11. Well, verse 10. I'll start in verse 10 of chapter 2 of Hebrews. Hebrews 2 and verse 10. "For it is fitting for Him for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings." That's what Jesus Christ suffered in all things, like as you and I do. "For both He who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one." Well, who is it that's being sanctified? Those that He has called out, you, and those that have received God's Holy Spirit are the ones that are being set apart, sanctified. That's what it means. And those, for both He who sanctifies, He who does that. Jesus Christ is the one that paid the penalty so that we can be sanctified. And those who are being sanctified, you set apart as family of God, are all of one. For which reason He is not ashamed to call them brethren. Right on their level, brothers in the family. And He said that He I gave that sermon, last time I read John, the 17th chapter, where he says, you and I are one. Make us one as we were from the beginning of the world. No, he said the Father is greater than I, always. But he didn't say that they weren't in harmony together. They were always in harmony together. And the family will be in harmony. He said, I'm your teacher. But how did he do it? On the same level. He taught them by becoming the lowest of the slaves in their presence. And he wasn't ashamed to do that. Now, I certainly didn't meet anything like Jesus Christ, but at least I did a little bit of the right example in teaching our children, or my wife and I did, so that at least they were willing to trust God, irrespective of what comes. If the authorities come and take them away, don't worry, Dad, God will take care of us. I'll never forget that, because that was very, very golden to me, that they were willing to trust God over and above anything that I could possibly do. And I really did appreciate that. Now, I want to turn to 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter. And start in verse 20, where this is the resurrection chapter. We all know that. I'm pretty sure you know that. This is the resurrection chapter. And the Apostle Paul here, writing to the Corinthian church, says, and now Christ is risen, verse 20, is risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep, of those that died. He is the first one resurrected from the dead. If you please, the first of the first fruits. For since by man came death. Well, Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, and they failed and ate of the wrong tree. And God told them, when you eat of that tree, you're going to die. They did. And so is everyone else. You know, it's given for man once to die. From that time on, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. Now, you know, man is capitalized there in my King James, New King James Bible, and it obviously means Jesus Christ. Verse 22 makes it pretty plain. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. We can see who the original man was and who the man was here. Adam was the first and Christ was the man. Because of his paying the sacrifice for us, we can all be made alive. But each one in his own order, Christ the first fruits. He set the example for any and all of us to be resurrected. Afterwards, those who are Christ's at His coming, then comes the end. And what's it going to be like? When He delivers the kingdom to God the Father. When He puts an end to all rule and all authority and power. I've read that verse a number of times. You know, in God's kingdom, there won't be any need for any of that. You see, God's law will be internal. He said, I'm going to write it in your hearts. God doesn't need the laws written down on paper or on stone. He doesn't need the commandments written out. Man does. But when man is gone and resurrected and becomes children of God, or if you please, literally born again into the God family, then he won't need that. There won't be any rule or authority whatsoever. It's what it says. He puts an end to all rule and all authority and power. There won't need to be any. We live in a world where it's automatic as far as we are concerned. You see, the whole world is structured that way. Now, I don't care how you want to say it as far as that goes. I try to make it real simple. It's a vertical structure as far as the world you and I live in. And the vertical structure means that there has to be a top, and then another step, and another step, and another step, all the way down to me, or down to us, at the bottom of the scale, whoever we are. And if you look at God's kingdom, it's going to be just exactly the opposite of that. And what is the opposite of that? Horizontal. Make it simple. Jesus was willing to take the position of the lowest of the slaves, down on that level, any level. Didn't matter. Any level. You see, chapter 21 of Revelation 21 and verse 4, I don't have that in my notes either, but this is the one verse that I always love. I always read this passage at funerals normally. I always read this passage as how it's going to be in God's kingdom in the ultimate final sense. Revelation 21 and verse 4. After it's all finished up, after Christ has turns it all back over to the Father. Now, verse 4. Revelation 21 verse 4. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Godspeed that day. There won't be any cause for tears. No sorrow of any kind. There won't be any cause for tears. There shall be no more death. It won't exist. We're going to live forever. Those that are alive are going to live forever. Those that refuse to obey, and after they've had the chance to have their mind open up fully and completely to it, and if they then refuse, they will have died before this. They'll be gone forever. There will be no more death. There won't be any death at all at this time. Nor sorrow. Nor sorrow. There won't be any sorrow. You won't say, oh my, I wish I had worked harder and I could have that man's position over there. You won't say that. Your position will fit you so absolutely perfectly that there won't be any sorrow. At least that's the way I read it. No sorrow whatsoever. Now, I can't do some of the things that you can do because that's the way God made us. We're all unique as far as individuals are concerned. What you can do and what you have the capability of doing, and you'll fit that so perfectly, ultimately in God's kingdom, that you'll never be sorry about it whatsoever. It won't have to be. At least that's the way I read that. There will be no sorrow. Nor any more death, no sorrow, nor crying. There will be no more pain. Speed that day when there won't be any more pain. And when you get old, well, you begin to get all in pains, you know. That's what happens. And I have a few of them. I guess that's a sign I'm getting old. For the former things have passed away. As I said, that's probably my favorite verse in all of the Bible. But that's what it's going to be like in God's kingdom when everything is all, everyone then becomes as a little child.